Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Amanpour Hour. Here's where we're headed this week. If universities really believe in free speech, are they missing the point of the student protests?
I do question how much the university administration understands the concept of free speech.
Then the renowned American rabbi who went to the protests in search of a moral message.
The thing that gives me hope is the people who walk in between the camps and say, friends, we are not enemies. We are all human beings.
Also this hour, anti-social media. Is TikTok really a danger to democracy?
But I wouldn't underestimate the propaganda angle. We got to stop playing the sucker.
Plus, what will it take for America to reclaim its reputation as a beacon for democracy?
Americans have lost the fundamental love of liberty.
And from my archive, 21 years since Bush's infamous Mission Accomplished speech, a warning from history about the day after in Gaza, and why a luxury apartment became a bargain rental in the push to provide affordable housing in Paris. Welcome to the program, everyone, and we start with the biggest anti-war protests on American college campuses since Vietnam. What began peacefully at Columbia University, a bastion of the historic student peace and justice movement, has spread to campuses nationwide and across the globe. Here in the UK, in France, Australia, and Canada, protesters have joined the calls to condemn the war in Gaza and divest from any connections with Israel's war. This week in America ends with law enforcement entering campuses from coast to coast, making more than 1,000 arrests as administrators call them disruptive and counter-demonstrators accuse them of anti-Semitism. As police were ending encampments and Trump and his Republican supporters were seizing on this as a campaign law and order issue, independent Senator Bernie Sanders, himself Jewish, stepped in with a lesson on history, on protest, and the definition of anti-Semitism.
It is important to understand why these protesters are out there. And they are out there not because they are pro-Hamas. They are out there because they are outraged by what the Israeli government is now doing in Gaza, which is bringing unbelievable harm, not just to the terrorist organization, to Hamas, but to the entire Palestinian people.
He also spoke of the polls in America that show a majority wanting a ceasefire in Israel's war on Gaza, and also the fundamental issue of constitutional free speech. Afua Hirsch is a journalism professor at the University of Southern California. She's British, of mixed white, Jewish, and African heritage. Afua, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
I said all that because I think you're perfectly positioned, not only as a professor on one of these campuses, but your whole heritage gives you so much experience, lived experience, as to what's going on. What was the last message you had as you were leaving campus to come here to London at the end of semester?
Yeah, so I taught my final class of a semester in which I am teaching my students to hold people in power accountable, to ask difficult questions and to stand up for the truth. That's the ethos of teaching, especially teaching journalism. And as I taught my last class of the semester and as my plane was taking off for London, I was receiving messages from students who were witnessing riot police entering campus after peaceful protests, and some of them being arrested and taken into police custody. So that was really my last experience as I left the end of this semester, and things have only escalated since then.
Now, at USC, the valedictorian, her name is Asna Tabassum, who is a Muslim, she said, "I was hoping to use my commencement speech to inspire my classmates with a message of hope. By cancelling my speech, USC is only caving to fear and rewarding hatred." What have the... Do you agree, by the way? And do you think the administrators could have de-escalated, just like on Brown, for instance, even at Northwestern?
I'm glad you mentioned Brown and Northwestern, because it's a reminder that these students actually have reasonable demands. This isn't just an excuse for some kind of spontaneous anarchy. It's hard to imagine how an undergraduate student who's made valedictorian presents such a great security challenge that it defeats the university administration. And many of us, and I include myself, feel that that was used as an excuse to justify a totally illegitimate attempt to try and pacify critics by removing her free speech.
Presumably, I mean, America has a written constitution, unlike ours here in Britain, that guarantees free speech. Universities seem to be completely, you know, floundering, trying to figure out where to draw the line.
I do question how much the university administration understands the concept of free speech and how much it understands the history of protest. The point of free speech is that people have the right to say things that you might find uncomfortable or inconvenient. There would be no need for a right of free speech if it was only protecting things we wanted to hear. And the accusation that protest is disruptive seems to misunderstand the point of protest. The leverage that students have in a world where they don't have much power is that they are able to disrupt. And if you look at the history of protest, its aim has been to disrupt with the intention of forcing people to hear demands and think about wider injustices. And that's exactly what these protests are doing. Now, there is obviously a responsibility for those in authority to protect safety. There has been a real lack of evidence that there was a threat to safety and security from the protest that happened. And, you know, when I speak to my Muslim students, they tell me that they feel that this is really about whose safety matters more. Because the idea that some students feel uncomfortable as a result of the protests and that that justifies arresting and using violence against those who are protesting really suggests that this is about a hierarchy of power, whose needs are more important and who's seen. And, you know, when you look at the history of protests, if you look at the civil rights movement in America, for example, take the Montgomery bus boycott. It wasn't always the initial demands of protesters that rallied wider public support. It was the disproportionate policing and the use of brutality to crush those protests that actually end up having the opposite effect to the one intended and really mobilise.
But I want to ask you this. As we talked about, each side has to be careful not to delegitimise their cause. So here's a Gazan-born Palestinian analyst, Ahmad Fuad Al-Khatib, who said, "Please adopt pragmatism as a necessary approach or ethos for actually getting things done, instead of wasting time with slogan drivel and maximalist activism that does nothing. Use your Western privilege to actually help the Palestinian people and promote a pragmatic path forward by engaging Israeli and Jewish audiences."
We don't look very much at protest and grassroots movements. And as a result, there's a tendency to depict them as these anarchic, disorganized, vague movements of these idealistic young people who don't really know what they're doing. I really would challenge that in this occasion. There is a very specific list of demands these students have, and they are themselves historically literate and aware of previous experiences, for example, the 1980s. In 2 years, 100 universities in America divested from companies that were linked to the South African apartheid regime. That had a significant impact on the viability of apartheid. These students are calling for disinvestment from Israel and companies linked to the Israeli military for a reason, that they believe in the potential of that demand to actually make a difference to the outcome.
And final question, because this is getting a lot of take on campus and those who are listening. Benjamin Netanyahu is a master of seizing the political moment, right?
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s.
I really resent the comparison. My grandfather lived through Germany in the 1930s as a young Jew. And he and many of his contemporaries became lifelong advocates of progressive politics. They were against ethno-nationalism and they were against the use of violence because of what they experienced. Those beliefs mirror exactly what these students are calling for. I mean, I would say to someone like Netanyahu, what does a protest against Israel's war in Gaza that isn't anti-Semitic look like? Because he is so quick to weaponize anti-Semitism, to shut down legitimate scrutiny and accountability for Israel's actions. I am not dismissive of anti-Semitism. We all need to be unequivocal in condemning anti-Semitism. We also need to be unequivocal in seeing and condemning Islamophobia where we see it. I don't draw a difference or a distinction between forms of racism, prejudice and discrimination against minoritized groups. My sense from the time I've spent in America, as well as my life in the UK, is that there is a great awareness for the problem of anti-Semitism and a willingness to take it seriously, which I applaud. Meanwhile, legitimate calls for a change in policy in the Middle East and the experiences, the lived experiences of Muslim students does not attract the same level of sympathy or awareness at all.
Afua Hirsch, thanks again for being on the program. And coming up next, we continue this conversation with a renowned American rabbi who went looking for common ground at the college campus protests. And later, Columbia University professor Tim Wu says it's time the West stopped playing the sucker on security when it comes to China and TikTok.
Having China in control of one of the world's most popular social media / propaganda tools seems like a terrible thing, terrible idea.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
At a time of so much anguish and grief over the war in Gaza and the civilian death toll, along with the lingering Israeli trauma of October 7th and so many civilian hostages still held captive, there are still those looking for a way to unite people and de-escalate the crisis. Rabbi Sharon Brous has visited both Columbia and UCLA campuses before the police were brought in to try and find common ground. She joined me from California to talk about what she witnessed firsthand and about the dangers of seeing the other in the most extreme way. Welcome back to our program, Rabbi.
Thank you so much for having me, Christiane.
Just first tell me, what made you literally get up and fly across the country to go to Columbia, and what did you see, and then also at UCLA?
I see the protests as a kind of growing out of a legitimate anguish and sorrow and moral concern that this war must end. And what I wanted to see and understand is that I have seen many videos and heard personal reports from people I care deeply about on that campus about a growing thread of virulent anti-Semitism in that place. And that is manifesting in people surrounding Jewish students saying things like, we're going to do October 7th again and again and again, and chanting things like, kill yourself, kill yourself, calling people Nazi bitches while they're walking down the street, etc. And so, this is truly a horrific new era that we've entered, where we see the normalization of anti-Semitism in a very dangerous environment and climate. And so what I want to do is both affirm the importance of public protest as a way of collectively grieving something truly terrible that's happening and thinking creatively about what might be born out of this moment.
I kind of wanted to ask you what you actually saw there. My question to you is, should the protest be viewed through the lens of the unacceptable behavior and the words of a minority? Because most people say it's mostly peaceful.
Right. And what I saw when I was on campus at Columbia last Thursday was peaceful. And there are Jews who are in part of this encampment as well. There was shared food. There was clearly a sense of both belonging and shared purpose and shared grief in that space. And that is really mm-hmm. critical. Yep. And so what I think is important is to acknowledge and call out where the language is violent, vitriolic, and maximalist, so that there can be a protest movement that is a protest for peace, that is actually using the moral imagination that college students are so good at mustering to imagine what a different kind of future might be possible. But there's a kind of gaslighting that's happening, Christiane, right now, when many Jewish students say that they don't feel safe on campus because some of this rhetoric is truly egregious and violent. Now, what I saw on UCLA's campus on Sunday was essentially the equivalent, but this time with a calling in of extremists from the pro-Israel side. And there was a conflagration, and we are really lucky that it did not turn more violent than it was, mm-hmm. because you have a kind of fueling of extremism here. And literally, I was trying to weave in between these two camps, saying to people, like, we need to de-escalate. You need to go home. This is not helping anybody for you to be here. And God forbid somebody gets truly hurt in one of these conflicts.
I want to ask you then to react to Brown University. It appears that the administration, the president of Brown, the administration of Brown, managed to de-escalate through talks and meetings and listening and talking with the actual students, who ended up removing on their own their encampment, with university leaders saying that they would discuss and they would later vote on the issues, whether it be divesting or whatever it might be. Is that a model that you would say should be taken up by more of these universities?
This is absolutely a model. There have to be grown-ups in the room. And Christiane, I want to tell you one thing that I witnessed when I was at UCLA. There was a group of people there who identify with Standing Together, which is an organization of Israelis and Palestinians who are working together to build a just and shared future. And one of the people who leads this group started chanting, "In Gaza and Tel Aviv, all children deserve to live. In Gaza and Tel Aviv, all children deserve to live." And I saw something absolutely breathtaking happen, which is we're right in between the Palestine Solidarity camp on one side and the pro-Israel camp on the other. And people on both sides started to clap and started to say those words, because those words actually make sense. And when you're fed a diet of extremism, you think the only answer is eliminationist. Mm-hmm. For my people to have justice, your people must be wiped out. But it's not true. We have been fed falsehood. And in fact, the only response to this will be when Israelis and Palestinians figure out how to build a just and shared future. So that's the grown-up voice in the space. That's the de-escalation voice. You're right to want justice. You're right to be concerned about safety. So are we. And our safety is tied up in one another's.
I again was struck by what you posted on Instagram, where you actually said, I think, if I'm not misquoting you, you said, Palestinians are not Hamas. In other words, they are not that movement. Maybe there are some, but it's not all Palestinians. And you were very, insistent in your sermon to your congregation that these people had to have the right. And as you say, this kind of, these wars, this kind of division would probably continue until everyone's rights are legitimized.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Palestinians are not Hamas. Most people just want to live in peace, mm-hmm. put their children to bed at night. They want to have their dignity realized. Palestinians deserve and need self-determination. If any people in the world ought to understand that, it ought to be the Jews, for whom self-determination was denied for so much of our history. And we understand the vulnerability that comes with living as a minority under another power. They need and deserve to live with dignity. And that dignity and that self-determination is not going to come at the expense of Israeli Jews having their freedom and having their self-determination. Both of these things are possible. And I think the work of the grown-ups in the room right now is to pull us back from the edge of the abyss and say, listen to the voices that are coming out of Israel and Palestine right now.
Rabbi Sharon Brous, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Christiane.
And coming up, sensational living. What other capital cities can learn from Paris when it comes to affordable housing for all? But first, Columbia University professor Tim Wu says it's time to start taking TikTok's threat to democracy more seriously.
But I wouldn't underestimate the propaganda angle. We got to stop playing the sucker.
Welcome back. We turn now to something roughly half the U.S. population uses and what it reveals about China's creeping influence into the West, the video sharing app TikTok. Globally, 1 billion people use it, but a so-called perfect storm has caused the U.S. to rule that TikTok must be sold. Its intense popularity amongst the young, it's loathed across the political divide, and it's a national security threat. Tomorrow, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, arrives in Europe for the first time in 5 years. But the United States has already set the tone with rare bipartisan and swift legislation, which will either ban TikTok or force its Chinese owners, ByteDance, to sell. Columbia professor Tim Wu says it's about time and that, quote, the democracies of the world have played the sucker for too long. Tim Wu, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
So what do you mean? Are you being a bit harsh?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think China has a terrible track record when it comes to internet rights and freedoms. And the idea they should be treated just like any other country, I think, is wrong. And so having China in control of one of the world's most popular social media / propaganda tools seems like a terrible thing, terrible idea.
What do you make of the national security aspect of it, which seems to be what pushed the U.S., you know, into such fast legislation and into the first such legislation in years?
I mean, they have been talking about it for quite some period. You know, I think the national security concerns are hard to fully evaluate without all the classified information. But the general sense of having an embedded app in tens of millions of people's phones, which both collects data on it, more data than anyone else, and also can, you know, be shaped to present whatever kind of message you might want. I mean, it's crazy. It's such an obvious propaganda tool. You know, want to sort of steer people towards one view or steer another. It's not that hard. And look, I agree there's other outlets that have that. I mean, frankly, so does any media outlet. But for this to be in charge of a state that we are effectively a contest with over the future of civilization is really intolerable.
And of course, they would say, hold on, we are not a Chinese state-owned corporation. 60% of our business is owned elsewhere. What do you say to that?
Well, if you want to prove that, sell TikTok. You know, ByteDance is always saying, on the one hand, we're not actually a Chinese company. We do what we want. But, oh, we can't sell TikTok because the Chinese government won't let us. So, I think there's a very clear track record of Chinese tech companies having to do what the Chinese state says. Whether that's expressed in forms of formal control, there is this golden share, or whether it's just the fact of founders going missing for periods of time or getting threats, it's clear that China exerts very strong control over its major tech platforms. And so I don't think ByteDance is by any means exempt from that kind of control.
ByteDance has been told to sell within 9 months or face a ban in the United States. And ByteDance operates and is headquartered in China. What is the result? Let's say this happens and somebody else buys TikTok.
The Western democracies need to be serious about this challenge and the struggle with China. You know, in many ways, the future of the internet is the future of civilization. And we're in an ideological and in some ways economic struggle with China and I think we need to take a little more seriously. If TikTok is sold to even another country that's more democratic, I think that's fine. And it sends a very important message, which is if you mess with the rights and freedoms on the internet, you don't get treated like a normal country.
And what should Europe do? Has it done enough to stand up against TikTok?
I don't think Europe has generally banned it for officials. I would call on Europe to take more seriously the issue of having a state with very different ideology than the Western democracies, a very different ideology in control of one of the most important propaganda and surveillance tools in the world. Mm-hmm. I think Europe needs to do more. I think they've been soft-pedaling this a little bit and saying, oh, this is just an American overreaction.
Since you're a Columbia University professor, and Columbia is the center of so much international, you know, gaze right now with all the protests, do you think that some of the accusations about TikTok use amongst the young, suggesting that it's proliferating Hamas propaganda and the like, A, do you think that's accurate? And B, do you think that played into the congressional speed with which it passed this law?
I've looked at the studies that have suggested that, and I don't feel I'm expert enough to opine. But I do think there have been credible studies suggesting that TikTok material tends to reflect the Chinese party state's view of the world, particularly on Chinese-related disputes like, Taiwan or Tibet or other places within China. And, you know, why wouldn't they? I think it's a serious danger, and I think it's not something we should just laugh it off. I should say during the Cold War, you know, the goal of the Soviet Union was always to incite infighting in the West, and, you know, we got a lot of infighting going on right now.
Lastly, you know, many would say, particularly young people, we've already seen them say, what do you mean banning TikTok? You know, this is how we get our information, our entertainment, etc. And many would say, what about the open, free internet, able to sort things out and regulate itself? What's your answer to that?
I'm a huge believer in the open and free internet, which is why we have to enforce the principles by telling TikTok and ByteDance to find a different owner for TikTok. If you don't enforce these principles, they disappear. And we've been sitting here allowing China, Russia, all these, Cuba, so forth, Iran, to violate all the principles of a free and open internet. If there's no consequences, the principles become a joke.
Professor Tim Wu, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And of course, ByteDance is likely to challenge all of this in court. Still to come, from the archive, a warning from history about the day after in Gaza from the blowback I saw firsthand after the Iraq war. But first, how luxury apartments became bargain rentals in Paris. We'll be right back with that story.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Welcome back. As France ramps up for the start of the Summer Olympics, the competition is making Paris an even more coveted and expensive destination for millions of tourists. But for people who live there all year round, skyrocketing rents have been forcing residents to move out for years. Now, local authorities are stepping in to stop Parisians from being priced out. Melissa Bell explains how renting a luxury Paris apartment could actually be a great deal.
The view is second to none, the location as central as they get. But this rent-controlled apartment is now Catherine's for just $800 a month.
Bienvenue. La première fois que je l'ai vu, j'ai eu un tel degré d'émotion que je me suis mise à pleurer.
And this is the building she was able to move into. Reopened amid great pomp in 2021 after some 16 years of renovation, the Samaritaine is one of the French capital's most iconic spots for luxury shopping and dining, not to mention its five-star hotel. But the Samaritaine was also obliged, as part of its reconstruction, to include 96 apartments for the city of Paris to let at modest rates.
If we let the market act, we will have only empty houses, second homes for foreigners or rich French people. If you want Paris to stay a living city with people inhabiting in the city, we must develop a lot of social holdings.
Across Europe, there's a danger of cities turning to museums and ordinary people being pushed out. But here in Paris, there's the added particularity that this was a city entirely redesigned in the mid-19th century. And that's exactly what gives it its beauty, but also what makes it difficult for the city to adapt to the needs of the 21st century.
All the more so that in the 20th century, social housing was built on the outskirts, in the so-called banlieue, where occasionally top architects were hired to design vast social housing and sometimes grand projects, like the Espace Abraxas estate that was built in the early 1980s. But for all their occasional grandeur, estates like these were kept at arm's length of the chic streets of central Paris, which meant long commutes for those who lived there. Then, in 2001, Paris's town hall was won by the left.
Nous, notre objectif, effectivement, c'est la mixité sociale et c'est d'éviter les ghettos. Éviter les ghettos de pauvres, éviter les ghettos de riches et donc faire du logement social prioritairement là où il y en a peu.
Private Parisian owners, wary of lowering house values, were, says Ian Brossat, just one of the hurdles that Paris's town hall had to overcome. In fact, the average price of a one-bedroom apartment in Paris has more than doubled these last 20 years and nearly tripled in some areas for two-bedroom homes, which in turn has made centrally located social housing all the more important. Already, it is one in nine Parisians that benefits. People like Zina, whose place in the Samaritaine development allows her to live close to the central Paris hospital where she works.
Comme on dit, c'est un musée à ciel ouvert, c'est agréable. Il fait vraiment très bon vivre.
An open-air museum that is now seeking to help those who keep its schools and hospitals running to be able to benefit from them too.
Melissa Bell in Paris with ideas that work. Still to come on the show, former Reagan Republican Robert Kagan on Americans falling out of love with democracy. But first, from my archive, the disastrous power vacuum and the insurgency that filled it after the US-led war in Iraq. And a warning from history about what happens next in Gaza.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And that was 21 years ago this week, George W. Bush's infamous Mission Accomplished speech, when he declared the end of major combat operations in Iraq. It became a symbol of premature victory and Western hubris, followed by years of continued conflict and bloody insurgency, reshaping the Middle East and America's role in it. Now, with efforts to get a ceasefire in Gaza, the same questions about the day after loom large, like who takes charge of security and reconstruction and the Palestinian right to self-determination. From my archive this week, the reality I saw firsthand in Iraq as America and its allies dealt with the chain reaction caused by Saddam Hussein's defeat.
Liberation brought laughter. And later, laughter gave way to looting and the first signs of a dangerous security vacuum. And into that vacuum, a decision was made that most agree was a fundamental mistake. Paul Bremer's first major order as U.S. administrator, firing the Iraqi army. In a protest outside occupation headquarters, many of the fired soldiers and officers threatened to turn against the Americans. And that seems to have happened. After long dismissing the insurgents as dead-enders, the U.S. is only now openly admitting their strength.
I think it is a very serious threat. These are very serious terrorists, some of them clearly from outside the country, perhaps increasingly so.
The U.S. military has not managed to crush them. Now the Iraqis will try.
We are mobilizing our police force. We definitely are mobilizing our army and make it ready to confront the enemies of Iraq and the criminals and the terrorists.
The violence threatens projects the U.S. has started and the Iraqi government plans to pursue, like democracy. The insurgency forced the U.S. to hand over power early, before they could oversee a permanent constitution or the first general elections as they had planned. Services are constantly sabotaged. The Iraqi government now promises to fix what a 15-month occupation could not. This is what Baghdad University students told us 7 months ago.
And we didn't ask the American government to send us to the moon. No, no. It's very simple. Our problems is very simple, like electricity, the water.
But today, electricity is still more off than on, as we found when we visited Gaith al-Jazari sitting in his darkened art gallery. Before the war, we used to make $1,000 a day, he told us. Now we barely make $200 a month. No electricity, no security, no customers here. Wherever you go, people can't shake their worry, no matter how fervently they hope the handover brings peace and quiet. Of course we're all worried about the problems and explosions, says Jaba Sabi. When we leave our homes, we say the Muslim prayer of death. We don't know what'll happen to us or whether our children will be killed. Lives, democracy, the economy, reconstruction, all held hostage by the constant violence. Those who have come to help are targets, and so are their Iraqi colleagues. Hassan, who translates for the U.S. Army, hides his identity against a certain death sentence, but he is defiant.
I want to say something to the insurgents, that they will not make me scared. All the interpreters are working. I will never get rid of my job with the Americans till they make this place and make my country stable and secure.
To stop the violence and spur recovery, senior U.S. officers say the porous borders must be sealed. Networks of informal routes used by the insurgents have to be closed down, and safe houses have to be destroyed. One U.S. officer tells CNN, this war has turned Iraq into a base for jihad and terrorism.
But even those like Gaith al-Jazari, sitting in his empty art gallery with no power, says at least they are free to hope now. Saddam's departure made Iraqis free of fear, he said. But feelings are complicated. At the Baghdad morgue, Dr. Nofal Shukr smiles when I ask him whether it's better without Saddam. He's come here to collect his uncle's body.
I believe it is better. It is better. But without America. If the American go out, U.S. Army go out, it is better. But if they remain here, it is bad and very bad.
But the U.S. Army is staying. It has to protect the new Iraqi government that has become a target as well. But the people hope by some miracle it will get better now they have their country back, mostly because they think that it can't get any worse.
But of course, it would get much worse as Iraq became a hotbed for jihad and terrorism in the following years that blew back all the way to Europe and the United States. As the world watches Israel's war on Gaza, Iraq stands as a reminder for Israel and America of what could happen without careful planning and a just solution for all. When we come back, former Reagan Republican Robert Kagan saw the stress test for American democracy as it was coming.
I think we just have to recognize that. It's not so shocking when you look at the entirety of American history.
And finally this hour, as debates around free speech pulse through college campuses, the next presidential election in the United States could be about the survival of democracy itself. But how did we get to this point where illiberalism threatens the global role model of a republic? Robert Kagan is a longtime policy expert who worked in the Reagan administration during the 1980s. His new book is called Rebellion: How Anti-Liberalism is Tearing America Apart Again. And I asked him how the U.S. made so many self-harming missteps.
I think we just have to recognize that. It's not so shocking when you look at the entirety of American history. These groups have always existed. What's happened now is they've taken control of the Republican Party, and they have someone as their leader who is willing to destroy the system. That's what he is. He's a wrecker. Americans have lost the fundamental love of liberty, the fundamental virtues that are required in our system. You know, it is not enough to only want freedom and liberty for yourself. In our system, you have to want it for everyone. And if you don't have that sort of sense of liberal virtue, the belief in these universal values, then you're willing to allow someone who is going to destroy them to take power.
And right after that interview, Time magazine released this cover story with Trump himself confirming those worst fears. Asked about all this talk about ending American democracy, he said, "I think a lot of people like it."
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.